So it's Saturday night here at the monastery, and it's also the day up in the Portland area, up at the Hermitage, our Pacific Hermitage, up in the Columbia River Gorge, just in Washington State, over the border from Oregon, that today was a memorial day up at the Hermitage, where there was a gathering of people to remember a good friend of the Sangha who passed away last year during the summer, and they decided to wait until now to go ahead and actually do the memorial service. It's not been quite a year since she passed. Her name was Karen Miller, and she's survived by a lot of family members, including her husband, Bob. So I was thinking about them today. She was just a good friend and just an incredible example of a very sincere and deep Dhamma practitioner. And leaves a lot of good memories from the time that she was on this planet, at least for the period of time that I knew her. So thoughts around death have been coming up a bit. And kind of coincidentally, just a day or two ago, I was fishing through a little notebook that I had in my yam, and came across a little slip of paper that I had tucked in there about a year and a half ago when I was at Chithurst Monastery in England. And it's just a little quote, or a little something that one of the monks had written up and put in a card for me as I was leaving Chithurst after being there for about 4 or 5 days, I guess. And the monk who wrote this as part of his card was Ajahn Titadammo, not to be confused with our Titapanyo, but Ajahn Titadammo, who is a monk who's been at Chithurst. He's I'm not sure, he's probably about 26, 27 Vasa, maybe, a few more than me. And he ordained later in life, so he's getting up in years now. I'm not quite sure how old he is, at least in his 70s. But, starting to experience, as one would expect, some illness or disabilities, bits and pieces of winding down. He was quite an artist. Some people may know his artwork, and sort of a general all-around philosopher. Very lovely being. And one of the things he's done is built his own coffin for when he passes away. And he's a very good craftsman as well. He builds a lot of beautiful small huts and different kinds of very buildings with a lot of character to them. So he has his own coffin now in his kuti, and I think there are even times when he sleeps in it. that's quite powerful, really, when you think about it. Anyway, I spent a little bit of time talking with him when I was there, and he sent me on with this card and this slip that I just kind of tucked into this notebook, and I thought I'd read it. Rather, I trust my memory to memorize it before coming in here. And what he wrote here was just very simple. When people are always waiting for you, do you always hurry up? When death has always waited for you, do you take no notice? So I just appreciated that and kept it. You know, just pointing to how we often live our lives, hurrying up, doing the things, going from place to place, event to event, moment to moment, without thinking too much about it, particularly when people are waiting for us or expecting us to do things in a certain way or expect us to be in a certain way. We're always rushing around, hurrying, not really paying too much attention. Pointing out that death is always waiting for us too. Do we take notice of that? Do we pay attention to that? So contemplation of death is one of the major contemplations that the Buddha suggests we take up on a regular basis. And part of the three heavenly messengers, Ajahn Yanago talked about those a little bit ago, old age, sickness, and death, to contemplate these three heavenly messengers. And, the fourth one, at the time that the Buddha was going, thinking about going for us, before he was a monk, adding the sight of the samana, the sight of the practitioner, but the three fundamental inspirations, seeing old age, seeing sickness, and seeing death, and contemplating those. And there's a lot of different good things that come out from these contemplations, and I think, you know, most of the time we associate, say, the death contemplation as one that will help wake us up, kind of shake us up out of our complacency, shake us out of our complacency. Establish a sense of sangvega, a sense of urgency, spiritual urgency. Because if we start to consider that life is very fleeting and that the human birth is very precious and not a guarantee, and that it all happens very fast, this life, then that gives a sense of urgency when we contemplate this to make hay while the sun shines, as they say. But it also brings up just a whole lot more other kinds of good things, I think. And sometimes it's easy to see it as just a sobering kind of contemplation, which it can and should be. If we really use contemplation of death and the experiences that we can find to remind us of it and to be very aware of it and to see it happening all around us and not to get worried or concerned or aversive and trying to avoid it or feeling uncomfortable around it, feeling awkward around people who are experiencing illness and death, and to just open ourselves to what it can offer if we just allow it to, then there's actually, rather than being anything that is morose or unpleasant, it can actually be something that's very moving and very poignant and very real. I think that's a good word. It just, you know, makes us kind of drop all of the unimportant stuff and experience a sense of authenticity in our lives, if we can just be with this and see it in ourselves and see it happening with other people. I can think of some of the most meaningful periods of my life when either I had a bit of insight into it for myself or in working with people who were facing death, and And just really reflecting on how important and meaningful and moving that can be. And as a former nurse, found myself when I was doing nursing, finding myself attracted to work in that area, and was moving towards getting involved with hospice nursing right about the same time that the 80s AIDS epidemic was starting to really take off. And found myself quite involved with that in several different ways. And they were really eye-opening times. I've talked about it before, but it made a lifelong impact in me, in that the intensity of the numbers of people that were getting very sick and dying very quickly, and how the communities were having to try and gather around that and deal with it, because it was a fairly unknown what's happening here. You know, before it was, the virus was identified and got a handle on some of the care aspects about it. It was very alarming to a lot of people. But there was a lot of goodness that came out of that time. I've always appreciated that, because it pulled a lot of people together, and it woke a lot of people up, and it caused a lot of people to start to examine what's important in life, what's meaningful, what makes it all worth it, worthwhile. And the amount of goodness that came out of it, the amount of authenticity again, realness that came, was pretty powerful. In situations like that, I also, during that time, was part of a volunteer organization called Shanti, to provide support to people with AIDS and also their caregivers and their friends, to help deal with it. And we had these training projects to train volunteers, and I, of course, took that and then became a volunteer trainer myself as time went on. But one of the things that we did as part of the training was this guided death contemplation. And I found that very powerful, too. And it was before I had a huge amount of exposure to Buddhism. I was starting to meditate and explore Buddhist teachings, but not quite full on yet. That was probably about 10 years or so before I decided to ordain and came to the monastery. And so my insights, you know, were pretty limited into what life and death was all about. But I do remember that during the guided death contemplation, when they take you through a full series of events leading up to one's death, and right up to the final moment when you're on your deathbed, and leading you through the last few hours and minutes of your life. And seeing what comes up, you know, where is your strongest attachment? It was kind of the focus of it. What is it that's the hardest thing that's coming up in this process? And interestingly enough, even at that time, I was less concerned about the demise of this particular body and mind, but the thing that kept on coming up over and over again was the grief at losing contact with friends and family. And that was what was sort of the major, and I wasn't expecting that when I went into that exercise. So it's a very useful kind of a thing to guide yourself through, you know, those final moments. What is it that you're holding to? What is it that you're clinging to? And I didn't know about things like craving and clinging and particularly to identity and things like that at that time. But it was interesting to notice that kind of grasping at the comfort and refuge in other people, family, friends. So it's a useful exercise to take oneself through that to see what you know where your attachments are, and maybe you know you discover something that you haven't seen before. But just exploring all the goodness too, and in the years since that time, and experiencing the death of different supporters of our monastery, and being with people as they go through that bit by bit, little bits, and then with my own mother a few years ago, her passing, which ended up being a very powerful experience, and very and not at all disturbing or not any grief really, just a real sense of poignancy of the you know, the human condition, and the gentleness and kindness and compassion that can be part of that experience of dying. And the realization several times along the way of all these years of kind of looking at it, that you know, that death is really just one moment. You know, everything leading up to it is still living. And so, you know, the fear of death isn't so much the fear of that actual moment of death in my mind. It's kind of like the things that come up are the, you know, the fears and the anxieties around, well, can I live through dying, so to speak. But death is really just one brief moment. The death of this body, anyway, death of this body and mind. So just remembering and actually using these contemplations and the times and the opportunities we have when there's family or friends going through these experiences to open oneself to it and to not be feel awkward or afraid, but just to allow oneself to be there in its fullness. And it's so important because these are times for family, for friends, for ourselves, when all of the facades can fall down, all of the projections that we put out onto the world of in ourselves, of who we think we are, who we want to present ourselves to be, who other people do the same thing, and watching, in the best of circumstances, those tendencies, watching those fall away, and something more real and more genuine can surface. And, you know, in the Buddhist philosophy, you know, Buddhist teachings, he talks a lot about in the suttas, there's a lot of references to rebirth. And I know some people who don't particularly believe in rebirth or that there's anything beyond this one body's and mind lifetime point to, oftentimes we'll say, well, you know, belief in rebirth is just a way of trying to, you know, offer yourself some reassurance as a way of escaping looking at the hard facts that this is it. But when I think about it, the fear of rebirth is much stronger than it giving any kind of solace. It's, you know, in some ways, the fear of rebirth is stronger than the fear of death. I often think that if I could convince myself that this was it, that this one lifetime was it, and then after that it's just total annihilation. You die and that's it, no more. then actually that's fairly comforting. We've got enough medicines and pain treatment and that kind of stuff now to just kind of, you know, live our lives doing what we want to do, and then, you know, take a big dose of intravenous morphine and just sail away and not have to worry about anything anymore. If I could convince myself of that, then that's probably what I'd end up doing. But I can't get there. It just doesn't make any sense. And when you look at the mind and you see the momentum of the mental processes from one moment to the next moment, I can't convince myself that that just stops but just because this body fades away. So I tend more to take the working hypothesis anyway, that there is rebirth as the Buddha teaches, and to let the motivation not be so much concern about death, but concern about how to stop doing it over and over and over and over again. Let that be a motivating force for the path, ending the suffering that comes with samsara. So we have to, Ajahn Chah's famous line, you know, we have to learn to die before we die. And as I understand it or contemplate it, it's letting all the causes for continued rebirth and samsara, for even in this own lifetime, this very lifetime, the causes that for suffering, the causes for dukkha, to understand them and to let them die. Let all the craving, let all the clinging to notions of ourself, what we hold on to as ourself, to let those die, so that the causes of suffering is what dies. The suffering is what ends up dying. And we realize how to die before the body actually dies. And of course, brings us back to asking, well, what is it that we hold on to? What is it that we identify with that causes us to establish this sense of clinging to something, to holding to something that's hard to let go of? And of course, that brings us to the contemplation of the five aggregates, the five khandhas. Body and mind, the mental aspects of feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness, and starting to see where it is that holding to those as who we are in any way, shape, or form is the root cause of this perception of self that we need to let go of. That's the root of our, the root of suffering. Now, the contemplation, as many of us know, you know, takes many different forms. Oftentimes, the quality of anicca is emphasized, looking at the changing nature of what it is that we refer to as our body and mind. And realizing that with such transiency in all of these experiences, if we hold to them, then we will experience dukkha when they change, when they fade away, when they pass. And that insight into anicca is kind of the prime one to focus on to establish that sense of a clear sense of uncertainty around what we normally refer to as ourself. I've also found it particularly useful to focus on the other two in some ways. Sometimes the anicca contemplation it's very useful, of course. The more you do it, the more you find it useful. But I was able in the early days to kind of convince myself that it wasn't such a big deal, transiency. You know, I remember before I took ordination, when I was a layman and getting to know the Sangha, just beginning my practice days with the Ajahn Chah Sangha, I took a few months off and went down to San Francisco. I was living in Seattle and went down to San Francisco to be an attendant for Ajahn Amaro and two other monks who were spending a few months in the Bay Area, and stayed with them in an apartment in San Francisco in the Diamond Heights area. I was there for about 6 weeks as their attendant and getting to know more of the teachings and the monks. And I remember having a conversation with Ajahn Amaro about impermanence and life and motivations and things like that. And I remember, I don't know how it came up, but I remember actually discussing with him that, you know, I didn't really feel so inclined to monastic life, that, you know, I had a good life as a lay person. I enjoyed, you know, my life. There were many enjoyable things in the world that I didn't think were particularly harmful, friendships, relationships, and, you know, just the general kinds of things. And that, you know, and we started talking about, he was bringing up, well, what about, you know, the transiency of these kinds of things? And I think my reply was something along the lines of, well, yeah, I know that, you know, these things don't last, you know, that they're, you know, they're always subject to change. And but really, you know, when something like this changes or goes away, it's really not all that bad. And I really think it's worth it. I think it's worth it. And just as I was even saying that to Ajahn Amaro and hearing myself say that, there was this kind of ring of, I'm not sure I really believe what I'm saying. This kind of sense of like, but I wasn't going to look at it. It wasn't, I wasn't ready to kind of contemplate that. And then I remember looking up at Ajahn Amaro, and he had this kind of just slightly wide-eyed look on his face. And I, you know, I don't read minds or anything like that, but what I thought I heard him thinking was, oh, this guy's going to suffer a lot. You know, poor guy. He doesn't know what he's, you know, he doesn't know what he's getting himself into thinking that. But that mood, that impression really registered in me, and I didn't say anything, and it's like we changed the subject. But it left a lasting impression on me that I need to really examine this assumption that it's worth it. But contemplating the aspects in terms of body and mind, in terms of dukkha, and in terms of anatta, not self, I find very useful too, because they really give particularly the contemplation around dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness of the five khandhas, or what we take to be ourself, or what we assume that there is some self that has some sort of control or ownership over these, or possession of them, that helps break that kind of illusion that leads to complacency. And just along the lines of, like, when you really look, say, just look at this body, is taking hold of it and assuming it to get some enjoyment out of it, to get some sense of security out of it, when we know it's going to change. We know it's going to fade away. We know it's going to, you know, get sick and die at some point, whether we go through old age or not. You know, hopefully we will, but why do we cling to it? Why do we cling to it as who I am when there's really no control over it? The body's going to do what the body's going to do. Why is that? Why do we not want to see that? What is it that holds us to thinking that this is something that is either who I am or something that I can control? Is there any... Does it make sense? Does it lead to peace? Will this make me peaceful if I think of this as something that I can control? Something that I only have to... want to experience pleasure for, ignoring the downside of it. Does that really lead to peace of mind? Deep peace of mind? Or the constituents of the mind, you know, the feelings, always searching for pleasant feelings and trying to ignore or pretend that that they won't change, or that the painful feelings, whether they're feelings in the body or feelings in the mind, emotions, those kinds of painful feelings, is that something that I really want to hold on to? Is that something that I really think identifying with is going to bring me some sort of sense of satisfaction, or that is going to bring anything other than a fleeting sense of pleasure? Why do I hold on to these things? Why do I seek them? Why do I consistently go after them, go for the short hit, rather than learning to see the danger of absorbing into that, of letting it continuously fool me? Is that going to really lead to peace? Can I find something deeper that is more... That is less unstable. Perceptions, you know, all the different ways that we program ourselves to view the world, our place in the world, who we are, our self-identification with certain roles in life. You know, whether it's our livelihood, whether we're monks or lay people, or our roles in the world as parents or whatever, identification with those, or the perceptions of other people, who they are, the fixed perceptions that we often have of people that we're having attractions to, kind of pigeonholing them in one way, expecting them to be one way, friends and partners, spouses, how we see them, how we solidify them into certain kinds of beings, or people that we have disagreements with or difficulties with, we form these images and ideas, these perceptions of who they are, and live with those constantly in our minds and in our encounters with them. Political situations, views and opinions about the world and how it operates. Do we find any peace in that? Why do we hold on to that? Why do we cling to those things and try and make them stable? Is it worth it? You ask yourself, is it worth my doing this over and over again? Is there a way that I can let go of this and move to something that's more peaceful? Not to mention the thoughts, the volitional formations, the ways that the mind then reacts and creates more opinions and views, and constantly recreating them by thinking or speaking, acting on them. And then consciousness, just that realm of trying to weave a sense of continuity of being by weaving together all of the sights and sounds and tastes and all the various aspects of the conscious world, as they dart past us, but we grab bits and pieces to create a sense of continuity and stability, and the amount of effort that that takes. And if we can, you know, not have to constantly do that, to create this illusion of a continuous self, you know, is doing that really profitable? Does it give us a sense of peace and well-being? So constantly looking at how we hold ourselves in relation to the five khandhas and contemplating this sense of, can I, you know, am I really doing this? Is this satisfactory? Does this result in any kind of, you know, sense of long-term well-being? This identification with the five aggregates, in separately or all together. Watching as it all changes, and how we have only a modicum, relatively little control over it. Yeah, it's enough to want to just start to work towards letting go of that. Yeah, one of the Buddha's famous admonishments to the monks. Monks, whatever it is that's not yours, abandon it. What is it that isn't yours? Form, the body, isn't yours, abandon it. Feelings aren't yours, abandon them. Perceptions aren't yours, abandon them. Mental formations aren't yours, abandon them. Consciousness isn't yours, abandon it. Whatever isn't yours, let it go, relinquish it. Die before you die. Die, let the self, let the perception of self die. There's a lot of different ways that the perception of self manifests. Two kind of core ways. One can think about in terms of, the 10 fetters that hold us in samsara. One of the first three fetters is the sakkaya ditti, the person, what they call personality view or self view. The abandoning of that kind of personality view, along with doubt, skeptical doubt, and attachment to conventions and rules and rites and rituals, abandoning those three fetters is what leads one into being solidly on the path. That self-view, sakkaya ditti, that sense of that there is me, some form of myself in relation to those five khandhas that I'm just talking about. But a more subtle form of self, too, that isn't abandoned until the very final phases, I guess you'll call them, or stages of enlightenment. The conceit, I am, which is a more subtle form of self-view, asmimana, the conceit, I am, which doesn't fade away until right at the very completion of the path. And there's a wonderful sutta that I'm sure most of you, or many of you, are familiar with, where a monk is experiencing a lot of severe illness, painful illness, and isn't doing very well. His name is Kemaka. And word gets out to a group of senior monks who are living nearby that Kemaka is ailing and failing, and they send a messenger, another monk, to inquire how he's doing. Asking him, are you doing well? Are you getting better? Are your painful feelings fading away and going away? And through the messenger, he returns the message, no, they're not. You know, in fact, they're increasing, not decreasing, and I'm not doing very well. And so the monks send the messenger back with another message, those senior monks. quizzing Kamaka, in a sense, along the lines of, you know, if you're possibly entering the last stages of your life, how's your practice been? Have you abandoned any of these, this sense of self? You know, what stage of understanding have you reached in terms of this sense of self? And his reply to the messenger is as well, in regards to my body and my feelings and my perceptions, my volitional formations, my consciousness, I don't see any holding to the notion that there is a sense of self in regards to any of these, whether it's in the form or apart from the form or possessing the form. I don't regard myself as being associated, a sense of self as being associated with either of any of these five khandhas. So the messenger takes that back to the five monks and reports that. And the five monks say, oh, well, he must be an arahant. You know, take this message back and say, you know, Venerable Kamaka, does what you say imply that you're an arahant? Completed your work? And so the messenger takes it back to Kamaka and conveys that message. And Kamaka says, no, that's not the case. Because even though I don't identify or hold myself in relationship to any of these five aggregates, yet there is still a sense of I am, a subtle sense that hasn't disappeared, it hasn't faded away. And sends back the messenger, and I think they send him back with another, you know, like, well, can you explain this? How does that? That doesn't make any sense to us. Kamaka gets a little bit, finally, just frustrated with this back and forth process. Say, enough, I'll just pull myself up and go and visit them. And so he gathers himself together and gets up and makes his way to the group of monks with all the questions and explains to them again how yet that he doesn't identify or hold in relation a sense of self in relation to any of the five khandhas, yet there's this subtle sense of I am, the conceit I am, that's still at play. And then he explains it with a couple of similes. Like he says, you know, imagine there's a flower and there is a scent to that flower. Can you say that the scent of the flower is in the petals of the flower or the stem or the pistils of the flower? And the monks say, no, it's, you know, not with any one of those particular things. It's with the scent is with just the entire flower. And also another simile of, like, suppose you have a cloth that you try to clean and you clean it and you clean it and you clean it until you use, you know, different kinds of soap or lye or whatever to clean it with, and it becomes pure and white and cleansed of all of the stains on it. Yet there still remains a scent of the soap powder or the lye or whatever it is you washed it with. That scent still lingers, and it's not until it's put in a casket with some other odor negating properties that then finally that scent fades away. He says, in the same way that this conceit, I am, lingers, this subtle sense of a being separate, a separate being is lingering until the conceit I am is uprooted. And it's such a profound teaching that during his offering of that reflection to these monks, he himself, Kamaka, becomes fully enlightened, the final deed is done, and that conceit, I am, just falls away through his contemplation and sharing that with these other monks. And similarly with the other monks, they also realize the fruits of arahantship at that moment from that teaching. So it's just a lovely set of similes that describes the subtleties, the sense of self, how it can manifest, and how to release from this continuous contemplation of the aspects of anatta around the sense of self. And to me, this is the core of how we become comfortable ultimately with the death process. Then, you know, we get to that point where even we have a bit of insight, or even a momentary experience, as the Buddha would describe, even a momentary experience of this sense of self falling away, and really seeing deeply the characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta very clearly, then even for a fleeting moment, that gives us this ability to die before we die. And then the mere passing of you know, flesh and blood, this body, is not so alarming, so difficult, so hard to bear. Just becomes a very acceptable, still poignant, but realization that this is just nature following its course, and we can't really point to this as who we are. To open ourselves to that possibility, and to contemplate that, and to see where our attachments are, to see where we cling, and to keep on abandoning what it is that isn't ours, until there's nothing left to abandon. So there's just a few thoughts that come to my mind with this occasion of Karen's memorial service up at the Hermitage, and a few other thoughts. So I'll leave it for there for this evening.